Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks this week. This week I thought we'd get into the topic of disruption overall. As you know, this is a general theme of Breaking Banks. It's sort of our modus operandi, if you like, and our reason for being. But one of the questions that always gets asked in this discussion is when you have a comparison of an Amazon or an iTunes and the level of disruption that's occurred in the print and the music business, are these fair enough comparisons to make in the business of banking? You know, that's one of the suggestions always raised. Isn't banking business different? You know, it's regulated. You have to have a charter. You know, there's all these different rules. Maybe it's different to these other businesses that have been disrupted. So what I wanted to do today was invite someone onto the show that is, if you like, an expert in this area of disruption in business generally, and he's looked at this from a number of different areas, and basically have a discussion from two futurists, those looking at the disruptive side of things, between Robert and I, and see if we can come to some conclusions in terms of how this disruption is going to play out in the banking space and the payment space over the next few years. So at this point, I'd like to invite Robert into the show, Robert Turchek. Robert, tell us a bit about yourself, about your history, a bit of the work you do as a thought leader, your recent published works and things like that. Give us a bit of picture for the audience of your background.
Hi, Brett. It's a pleasure to be on your show. I'm excited to be here today. I've been a big fan of your writing for a long time and happy to get to know you on the radio now.
Thank you.
For myself, I've been involved in what they now call disruptive media for about 20 or 25 years. But back in the day, we didn't call it that. We didn't have that term. We were simply launching new services. And I started out my career in television. I launched TV networks all over the world, principally for MTV. They sent me over to Asia, and then later I worked elsewhere in the world for them. I ended up running their on-air branding worldwide. But when I was doing that, that was in the early 90s, I noticed that our audience was starting to use things like game consoles, the 16-bit Nintendo and Sega game consoles, and this new thing called dial-up bulletin board services. This is in the very early 1990s.
It's a while ago.
Yeah, and I looked at that and I thought, well, gosh, these are also screens. These are a kind of entertainment that runs on a screen, even though it was not nearly as good quality as the television at that time. And I thought we ought to really be there for our audience. Our audience is migrating to these new devices. Well, that idea didn't really resonate with a TV company in 1992. That was a little too early for them to get their heads wrapped around. So I left there, even though I loved that job. I left MTV.
MTV.
It was an awesome gig.
Really cool.
Yeah, it was an awesome gig. I got to do whatever I wanted. It was the most creative job in television. And I came out to the West Coast and started a game company, one of the early computer game companies, and it was quite successful. We went public in 1994, and then that gave me the freedom to pursue whatever I wish. And by that point, I was hooked on this idea that there was an intersection between television and traditional mass media and the telecommunications network, the two-way network, not a one-way broadcast network. And in the middle, there was software. And, of course, that emerged as the Internet. It took a long time, but now we have just about every one of those media businesses is migrating over to this two-way network. And in the process, they have to really reconsider what they do because, a television company or a music label, they're broadcasting, right? Their job is to send the signal out. They're not really interested in hearing back from their audience. The only medium that works that way is talk radio, really.
Right.
And so these companies have to change their entire process, not just how they do business or their business models. That's what they tend to focus on, the economics of their business or the legalities around the business. But what I urge my clients to do is to rethink their whole business process, from how they create shows and how they engage with people early on before they've launched a show. How do you invite the audience to participate with you? And so that causes them to rethink marketing and programming and branding and positioning and packaging and eventually pricing. Today, what I do is I work around the world with companies, usually the leadership of a company. They'll bring me in. They'll say, look, we understand it. We're facing massive disruption. We need to make a major change, and we need to do it very quickly. Can you help? sometimes that's a strategy job. Sometimes I'll look at their product. Sometimes I'll work with their product line managers. But sometimes it's just a message. I need to give the message to the rest of the company. You know, today most companies have a digital media group or digital marketing group, and they're down the hall, and you know, they usually have the digital portfolio. If some new disruptive threat occurs, well, they just take it down the hall and chuck it on the desk of those people in the digital media group. And what I try to encourage companies to consider is that their entire business is now a digital business, and it's every person's job in the company to focus on those threats from disruptive digital technologies. They need to focus on that, understand them, and become comfortable with them. That's easier said than done. So some traditional companies have a really hard time with this. But it's actually a fun business for me. I really enjoy helping people make that transition, so it's a pleasure to work with them.
Great. We're seeing a lot of disruption in the way people are viewing movies right now, obviously, viewing content. Video is huge, you know, things like Vine and other stuff. You know, we have huge amounts of video being uploaded to the cloud right now and through mobile. But at the same time, people's viewing habits have changed where now, you know, we're not so scheduled in our TV or viewing watching. You know, we're sort of more interested. We follow shows. We'd like to watch them at a specific time. So how has people's consumption of media, what effect is that having on the business model for content creators who make those programs and the distribution of those programs?
Well, you covered a lot of things there in one question. Those are all interesting trends, and they're all very accurate. They're very true. The heart of your question, though, I think at the end is, how does the change in user behavior change the business model? It depends on the kind of company that you are, right? So if you're in the business of producing television shows, ironically enough, this is a fantastic time to be in business. It's a great time because there's more demand than ever. With every new platform that comes along, a company like a Netflix or, say, Amazon Prime, their subscription video service, these companies are all producing original programming. They understand that to attract and retain subscribers, they need to offer more than just the old catalog of movies that they launched with. And so Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, even Microsoft's Xbox service, they're all producing original programs. So that means it's a great time to be in Hollywood and be producing shows because there are a lot more customers purchasing. This always happens. Now, in the television industry, we have a lot of instant amnesia that sets in. So people tend to forget that we had this process happen once before in the 1990s. And probably it happened in the 1980s as well. Because every time there's a new platform, then those platforms need programming. In the 90s, I was familiar with this because we were launching satellite channels all over the world. So every time a satellite system would go up, usually the way the governments would do it, they would try to have two systems so there'd be some competition. Well, when you have two satellite systems competing, they both need programming, and that creates a bidding war. There aren't that many studios to provide programs. And so that means that the studios get to jack up their prices. They can play one platform off the other. And I can guarantee you that's happening right now. So, you know, Netflix comes to town. Everyone knows they need programming. They're looking for new programming. Well, the studios can play them off of their traditional customers, the broadcast networks and other outlets, and so they can extract more money. So the TV programming business is doing great. Now, TV broadcasting, that's a business that's beset with challenges. They're having challenges on every front because people's consumption patterns changing. That's what you mentioned in the beginning of your question. What we're seeing is that people don't want to sit down in front of a TV at 8 o'clock and watch a primetime show.
They'd rather watch it than cable.
Well, cable's a different issue altogether, but with broadcast TV, their old model is you get a huge audience to watch at 8 o'clock or at 9 o'clock. You know, everybody in the country has to tune in at the same time. That model's crumbling pretty quickly. So people are migrating to different devices. You know, things like a DVR that allows you to time shift the show, or a service that lets you watch it on demand later. So you no longer assemble an audience at the exact same moment, and they're having to change the way they package and sell advertising to advertisers to reflect the fact that the audience is now tuning in at different times. So that mass audience that was always the strong suit for broadcast TV, that mass audience is starting to crumble. So there's been a dramatic reduction in the size of the audience. We've seen primetime audiences drop by 50% in the last 10 years for broadcast. Now, cable, what's happening in cable TV is that people are starting to grumble a lot about how much they pay for their TV programs. You know, so if you sign up for cable, you're probably paying something like $75 or $80 a month for your cable package. Okay. And people are starting to question that. That's a pretty big expense. And they're saying, well, why do I pay for all these channels that I don't actually watch? So consumers are starting to question the value of the cable bundle. They haven't started to do much about it. People haven't actually unsubscribed from cable in a big way. We haven't seen unsubscribing or what they call cord cutting in huge numbers yet.
When do you think we're going to start to see that?
Well, you see, I have this discussion with analysts all the time because they say, Rob, you're always talking about cord cutting. You're talking about consumer behavior changing, but there's no evidence of that. Only 1% of the cable audience in the U.S. has unsubscribed. Well, that's because when you call your cable company, you tell them you want to drop cable. Typically, we sign up for cable broadband internet, and they throw in the telephone along with the video service. You get this package, this bundle. If you call your cable company and say, well, I want to keep the broadband, but I'll drop the phone service and I'll drop the video service, the cable company will say to you, look, if you keep the video, we'll make it the same price. If you drop your video, we're going to jack up the price of broadband. So you're better off just keeping the whole thing. So, of course, nobody's going to unsubscribe, under those circumstances. So people are tending to stay with what they've got right now.
Is the change in the landline business in the U.S. predictive of what's going to happen with the cable, you think?
Yeah, I think that could happen. What happened with landline is in the 90s, everybody signed up for a dial-up service. So we bought a second line because we didn't want to tie up our home phone. So we bought a second one that connected the internet. And then when broadband came along, we no longer needed that second landline. So then there was a massive number of people who unsubscribed from their landline service. And now what's happening is people are switching over to mobile. I stopped having a landline a couple of years ago because I'm never in one place for long. And so, you know, as people migrate over to mobile, that jeopardizes the traditional copper in the ground landline phone business. And those telephone companies haven't really done a brilliant job of upgrading their systems for fiber. You know, they've done it in a patchwork fashion. They've wired up the easiest neighborhoods in the U.S., but they haven't done it in a nationwide way. And so there's a real possibility that the landline telecom business will dwindle and people will migrate over to mobile because mobile continues to improve pretty rapidly. Now, in the future, you might see a scenario then where your mobile operator can compete with a cable company and offer video through a mobile network. And that sounds really great, and I have a lot of experience with mobile video, but I can tell you we're a long way away from that right now because you just don't have the bandwidth in the wireless network to put a proper
unless you're in South Korea, right?
Yeah, well, you know, Korea is an interesting country because there, the government's a little more active in industrial policy. So the government there decided more than a decade ago that there were a few strategic industries that they wanted to be a leader in, and they wanted to support the entire population being smart about those technologies. And so they mandated that consumers would have access to high-speed broadband and high-speed wireless. They basically decided to create an entire population that was conversant with those technologies. I think it's brilliant. I mean, it's not the sort of thing we do in the U.S. Our government doesn't intervene that way in markets.
Yeah.
But they did it in Korea, and as a result, you're seeing Korean companies that truly have leapt onto the world stage and have displaced the giant Japanese electronic companies. Yeah. And they're challenging other electronics companies around the world. You know, companies like Samsung and LG really have punched above their weight class for a long time. I think it's a stupendous story, and it's a great illustration that, you know, the only approach isn't a market-based laissez-faire economy, that, you know, interventionist government can't actually get it right from time to time.
But they've also built mobile-to-purpose content, haven't they, in terms of TV and video, right?
That's true. Well, we're starting to see a lot of original programming, not just in Korea, in just about every country. You're starting to see a giant amount of original programming come out onto digital devices and mobile devices. We don't compare them. So, for instance, if you're a TV analyst, your definition of television is other TV channels, other TV networks, and you don't really measure that against, say, YouTube video or video that's on Vimeo or Metacafe. We put those in two different categories. I think it's foolish because the consumer doesn't do this, right? The consumer looks at it on a tablet or a phone, and they're watching video, and they don't care if it comes from a broadcast network, a cable channel, or YouTube.
Right.
But when you talk to TV programmers, they get pretty defensive about that. They say, well, that's a bunch of web junk. That's not television. We don't measure it. We don't compete with that. I think they're out of their minds, because if you look at teenage behavior today, kids migrate freely across all these services and they don't distinguish between them.
So I don't know what the figures are for something like MTV or the Music Awards or something where Miley Cyrus appears, for example. But I do know that there's a very interesting video blogger. He goes by the handle of PewDiePie. And this guy, he gets 100 – he's the top YouTube channel in the world. He's based out of Sweden. And he gets 190 million views a month. And this guy reviews video games and things like that on his channel. And he just – unseated Miley Cyrus as the most popular, YouTube content provider, content provider on YouTube. And it's phenomenal to see how, 190 million views a month. I mean, what TV station gets 190 million views a month?
Well, bear in mind, those are asynchronous views that are added up, so they're cumulative. That might be a smaller number of people coming back repeatedly. And if he's producing content the way I would suspect, he's probably doing something daily, so he has built an audience that's got to have it. So it's probably a smaller audience that comes back quite often. But your point is a valid point. You know, you're starting to see people on YouTube who can get an audience that rivals a cable TV channel. Probably not a broadcast network, because a successful broadcast show is going to get 5 million or more viewers simultaneously. But a cable channel, even in prime time, a cable news show might have 175,000 viewers or 250,000 viewers. Those are numbers now that we're seeing bloggers easily be able to reach. Yeah. And again, the story hasn't been explained in that particular way. Now, here in Los Angeles, where I live, the phenomenon is well understood, and there are literally dozens of multi-channel networks launching, companies like Maker Networks and Machinima. These are companies that are aggregating a bunch of those video bloggers on YouTube. And then they do all the back-end management. They help them scale their social media, and they also handle the ad sales. So they do all, basically, the network functions, and they're creating kind of virtual networks on YouTube. It's a very interesting business. It's a pretty thin-margin business right now because they all have to live within the economics of YouTube, which, frankly, aren't great for content providers.
Right.
But it's quite an interesting phenomenon. What you might notice, if you look at these channels, that's interesting, is the quality is very poor. And this is something that blinds TV companies. When they look at YouTube, they see somebody in their living room, or somebody in their bedroom or a dorm room or whatever doing a video blog, and they look and they go, "Well, that's not television. That's some kid with a video camera."
Yeah, sure.
So they can't even consider that a kind of competition. But they're missing the point entirely. The consumer doesn't care. Quality is no longer about production values. Now, this is anathema to broadcasters because they're all focused on high definition and they want to migrate to ultra-high definition. You know, so they'd like to get to an even higher threshold of quality. That doesn't matter. In a world of search, quality is determined by relevance. Quality is determined by how closely is your message match what I'm interested in. And I'll accept crummy video or highly compressed. Yeah, I think it's a really important thing to get, right? So in search, quality equals relevance.
Absolutely. Well, Rob, what I'd like to do after the break, this is a really interesting discussion, but I'd like to talk about disruptors generally and if you've seen some patterns in who's effective at disrupting and why incumbents find it difficult to shift in the midst of disruption. So stick around. You're with Brett King and Robert Turchek on Breaking Banks. We'll be right back after this break.
Comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient efficiency for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit Kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
Did you ever stop to think that financial health can be a lot like physical health? The financial physician, Luz Katigna, has helped people on the radio for nearly 15 years. And now he's part of the Voice America Business Channel. By using medical analogies to discuss financial solutions, Lou actually makes the process easier to understand and will help you chart your own financial fitness. Tune in to The Financial Physician live every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time, and on demand anytime on the Voice America Business Channel.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Brett King on Breaking Banks. A quick shout out to Jim Morales, who's once again on Twitter and saying hello. Thanks, Jim, for joining us and retweeting. So, Robert, just in respect to this theme of disruption we were talking about before the break, with the content providers, you said there's real strong demand right now in terms of new original content, but there is a change in the way people are consuming content. So I'm interested to talk about this, you know, just from an overall industry perspective. Mm-hmm. When we've seen disruptions in recent times in terms of newspapers, books, and the music industry, you know, those traditional players that have been involved in distribution of the businesses, these guys have really felt the pain, you know, the Borders, the Blockbusters, the HMV music stores and so forth. Right. But the content producers seem to, survive better in this transition because it's just a new distribution layer for them. Is the same true of the media business, you think?
It's true and it's not true, right? So the first point there is, in a world of physical objects, physical media or any other physical product, in the case of banks, money, cash, physical cash, you need to go to a place to get that stuff. And so distribution is really important. It becomes a major value control point because that's where the customer actually gets to touch the product. In a world of digital delivery, now the customer can get it delivered to whatever device they happen to be in front of, and distribution becomes trivial, really trivial. And so the value of distribution has eroded really quickly. And we saw this more than 10 years ago, but the companies that control distribution have long-term carriage commitments, you know, they have contracts, so they have business rules that have governed the content that they distribute that's been able to help them preserve their position. But we're starting to see that control point erode. Now, in the new, you know, once things are reconfigured, let's look at the music business.
I mean, can you measure that, because we've had a net decrease in viewers per channel or per program, for example?
Well, it hasn't hit television so quickly yet. TV has been remarkably resilient in the face of the onslaught of the internet, and I can talk a little bit about why that's the case. TV has a lot more defenses, and frankly, it's a much more sophisticated business model than music. But if you take recorded music, it's a very simple business, right? An artist goes to a studio, records and masters an album. The album's pressed in a plant, and now it ships out on a shiny disc. So it's a really one-dimensional business. The entire industry is single-threaded on that CD. And for a while, that was a fantastic business. You know, throughout the late 80s and early 90s, that was a booming business. It was a cash machine for the record labels because they were selling their catalog to people like me, baby boomers, who went out and bought, you know, everything they had on vinyl. They bought it again on CDs. That was a great big business. Right. A lot of people got hooked on the cash, and you had accountants being paid $500,000 a year and driving Maseratis. So that was the record business until 1999. And then Napster came along, and very swiftly we started to see the music business lose 10% or 20% each year, and it declined very quickly. So over the course of the 2000s, that whole decade, the music industry collapsed to about a quarter of its size, and that's a gigantic shock to the system. Now, as early as the 1990s, I would advise the record labels and say, look, you need to shift from being a physical product, and you need to start to reconsider it as a digital service, not a physical product. That phrase didn't mean anything in the 1990s to a record label. They would hear me say it, but they did not understand what I was talking about. Well, today, here in 2013, we've got dozens of digital services, fantastic services like Spotify and iRadio and so forth. These are great services that delight consumers because they can discover more music than ever. It plays on the device that they want, so it's where they want it, when they want it. They don't have to download and store and manage a library of music. All that stuff is gone. So we've ephemeralized the music offering. We've vaporized it. We've turned it into pure software that can be downloaded to any, that can be streamed to any device. That turns out to be a great convenience for consumers. It's also a great efficiency, but frankly, there's a lot less money in that ecosystem, and so less money is flowing back to the artists, not just to the distributors. The record labels have kind of turned themselves into a marketing engine or marketing agency for artists. They're signing 360-degree deals that give them a great deal of control over that artist's career, and they're able to extract revenue now from everything, no longer just the recorded music, but also from the live performances and merchandise. So the record industry has gone to great lengths to reconfigure itself. But I wouldn't say that the artists have necessarily benefited from this. Right. And I think if you were serious about being in the music business, or frankly any kind of content business, today, then what you must consider is being your own producer, your own publisher, and your own distributor. In other words, you got to do it yourself. And that is why the people who are doing video on YouTube have been so successful, because they manage their own social media, they manage direct relationships with their audience, they respond directly to their audience, and they really control those audience relationships. Effectively, they built their own channel on top of YouTube. That is a disruptive use of technology. But what it's disrupting is the role of the packager and the distributor. And the artist has to do that work himself. So the artist has to work much harder, but they can't actually build a business. As you pointed out a minute ago, there are some people who are producing YouTube videos who are making millions of dollars a year. I know, yeah, it sounds astonishing, but they literally are making millions a year because they reach hundreds of millions of views in a given month. So it can be a, yep, business. It's a lot of work, though.
Well, and like, you know, you look at some of these people like Michelle Phan, or I can't remember the sisters now that I can't remember their name now, but they have these YouTube channels, for example, doing makeup tutorials. Yeah, and these, exactly, girls now have created their own cosmetic lines and all, right, sorts of amazing sort of possibilities from that. So one of the things I've noticed, and you know, you've heard me talk about this before, but maybe some of the listeners haven't, is I like to, when I look at examine the disruption of these distribution layers, particularly with music and books, the real shift in instinct for buying a book or buying music didn't necessarily occur when you could buy the physical product through an electronic store, but it occurred when the product was completely digitized. So in the case of books, when you could download a book directly to a Kindle, and, you know, the Kindle's still a physical product, theoretically, and the iPod as well. But when you could download a book to the Kindle or music to the iPod, that's when the value of that physical store was really challenged. Now, TV is already, to some extent, a digital content because it's transmitted over the airwaves. So it's not quite as clean a comparison, is it, in that respect?
Actually, what you're touching on is one of the reasons why television's been able to resist, or, you know, persist in spite of the internet. So any business where the physical product had to be delivered to a store, a book, a record, a video game, we've seen all of those businesses get massively disrupted, because gradually, as those products could be delivered digitally, you no longer needed to go to the store, and the store suddenly didn't have a reason to exist. So there goes Blockbuster, there goes the warehouse record company, there goes Tower Records. We've seen that happen, Borders Books and so forth. So kind of the story of the last 5 or 7 years has been one big chain after another going out of business. So I think there's a big lesson there for companies. If the product that you're selling, if the value is encoded into a physical object, and your whole business is based on moving physical units, and yet there's a lot of information content inside of that physical unit, you are at great risk, because someone's going to figure out how to unlock that information content and deliver it over a digital network at much lower cost much faster, much cheaper, and directly to the device that someone else wants to watch it on. And they don't need to buy the physical product, they don't need to go to your physical store, and they don't need to stand in the line. All those things go away. Consumers very quickly migrate. We don't even think about it. And so to your point, you know, we saw a huge shift when Amazon Kindle came out. We saw a massive shift. People started buying e-books. They realized, I don't need a library full of books anymore. I don't need to clutter my life up with all this collection of stuff. I can just have them on my Kindle, and I can download another one immediately. If I finish that book, I can get another one in an instant, and it's there for me. So that's such a great convenience for people that it really removed the need to go to a bookstore. Now, with television, television's a little bit different, right? Because TV is already very convenient. It comes to your house. It comes packaged up in a very appealing package. I'd argue that the cable bundle is actually pretty good value for entertainment. You know, we watch it 4 hours a night, so we're getting a lot of value out of that every month. And so people are pretty used to it. People are pretty comfortable with it. And the TV industry has been smart about doing the minimal amount of innovation necessary to stay in the game, so they haven't allowed themselves to become disrupted. They have a lot of rearguard defenses. Let me take a second and explain to you what TV Sure. does to defend itself, because I think it's quite interesting. The first thing is content lockout. So if you consider like HBO, HBO is a premium channel that is purely a creature of pay TV. It doesn't exist in the wild. It only exists inside of the cable TV or satellite TV universe. It's not out there on the internet. Now, they have a service called HBO Go. That's their digital service that allows them to get onto tablets and phones. But you can only get access to that service if you subscribe.
But haven't they launched subscription of that independently just in the last few weeks?
If they're testing it in Scandinavia, I think in either Sweden or Norway, but not in the U.S. And they won't, because candidly, they have 4 billion reasons a year not to do that in the United States. They thrive in this pay TV universe, so they have every reason to try to preserve it. The way they use that service in the U.S. is it's a stalking horse for negotiations. So when they're talking to their distributors and they want to extract more money from them, they'll say, well, we have HBO Go. We could go direct, and you know, we won't do that if you give us the following. So they use it as a negotiating tactic right now. It's an excellent product, by the way. If your listeners haven't checked out HBO Go, it's the very best of these TV everywhere applications. But there's one big issue with it, which is that you have to be a subscriber to cable. So they're using innovative technology to reinforce an old business model. And to me, that doesn't last. That's not a sustaining idea. That's a short-term tactical thing to do, but I don't think it's a long-term strategy. But again, I think HBO has executed brilliantly. Other cable channels have tried to do something similar to varying degrees of success. But anyway, content lockout. HBO will not license their programs to Netflix. They've been very clear about it. The CEO has spoken several times about it, just said, sorry, we're never going to do it. You'll never see an HBO show on Netflix. So Netflix would love to get that content. That would make Netflix quite a compelling alternative. It might convince some people to drop cable, but HBO won't do it. So the first defense is content lockout, where a content company says, sorry, we're not interested in your new business. We're not interested in your new platform, and we don't want to get disrupted, so you can't take our content. We're not going to let you do it.
Right, so you have to have enough new original content that starts to compete with their content.
That's exactly why Netflix and Amazon Prime have gotten into the original programming business, and Hulu, and frankly, every one of these companies. They have to, because they can't get the product that they need. They can't reliably get the content that they need from the traditional providers. Now, the second big defense is lobbying. So the media companies are highly regulated, just like the banking industry. It's a regulated business.
Yep.
And so they can always go back to Congress and lobby, and they can get new legislation passed that favors them. And there are all kinds of arcane rules about how the TV programs have to be sold and distributed. And those rules, they won't allow those rules to be applied to Internet distributors. Now, every season there's some legislator in Capitol Hill who would like to propose a change to that, but these are powerful lobbies. And so it's unlikely that that will change anytime soon. I expect that to last for quite a while. Then there's litigation. And litigation is a powerful defense for a media company. They have copyrights that protect their content. If you were to come along and launch a cool new service, so it was the Brad King video service that allowed people to download and watch TV shows whenever they want to, well, if that business model doesn't appeal to a broadcaster, they can invoke copyright law and they can sue you for copyright infringement. So what they've done is they've taken this government-granted monopoly copyright, and they've turned it into a kind of veto power over innovative technology, which is never what copyright was intended to be, but that's how it's used in the hands of a media company. They use it as a giant club that they can beat your startup company into submission with. So, for instance, right now in New York, there's a startup company called Aereo that's backed by Barry Diller. And he's a very flamboyant and outspoken and smart media executive, and he has invested a huge sum into this company, Aereo. Aereo, it's an interesting proposition. It's like a workaround certain rules, but essentially what it means is you get, as a subscriber to Aereo, you get an antenna in a warehouse in Brooklyn, and it allows you to tune in and time shift all the shows that are on broadcast TV, and you can then access them on any device. So think of it as like a DVR that allows you, you can access your own DVR from any anywhere you have to be.
Yeah.
But they've turned it into a subscription product, so you don't have to manage the DVR, and they're recording everything, and so you can get whatever show you want. It turns broadcast TV into an on-demand service. Right. The problem is the broadcasters have not agreed to that, and they haven't licensed their content to Aereo. They refuse to license their content to Aereo, and so they've sued Aereo. There's two huge lawsuits that are wending their way through through the courts. Now, industry pundits look at this and they say, well, you know, we're going to see a lot of principles tested here, and in the next few years, it'll take a while for that lawsuit to come to a conclusion. Some analysts say that Aereo will lose because they're transcoding the content, and that's not permitted. That's the legal test that's coming. I look at it, and I think probably Aereo will prevail. I would bet on Aereo. I think it's going to prevail, but it's going to take a few years. But in the meantime, Aereo is going to be spending $10 or $20 million a year defending itself from these lawsuits. So litigation is an extremely powerful weapon because you can stifle an innovative company. You can take all the startup capital and absorb it in lawsuits.
Yeah, it creates a barrier to entry, right?
That's the idea. So I think, you know, those three techniques, content lockout and then regulation and legislation and then finally litigation, these are great defenses that the media companies have.
So just before we go to the break and getting back to banking, you know, we talked about the physical product. And once you, if you have a physical product that can be disrupted or distribution can be evolved, then, you know, that's when the big harm moment or when the big disruption can occur. So in banking, the primary physical product we have today is a debit card. Right. And there's, you know, there's over 400 mobile payment startups today. One of them you were talking about, or a payment startups, one of them you were talking about on your Facebook page today, Coin, who's making some noise today. But once we can download, once we don't need a physical card and we can download our bank account to our phone, what impact do you think that that's likely to have on physical distribution of your bank account?
So it's a great set of questions, right? So the example you just cited, Coin, is it's basically one smart card that absorbs the functionality of all the other credit cards that you have, and your ATM card, and your debit card, and your loyalty cards from the, you know, from the gas station or the grocery store or the drugstore. You can basically scan all those in using your phone, and then this one card now contains all the information from all those cards. You wouldn't want to lose that card. It makes it a very valuable card, but it means you can take all that other stuff out of your wallet. You can literally de-physicalize those cards. I think it's a brilliant idea. Obviously, they're going to benefit because that company, Coin, is going to get the aggregate data of where you're spending and what you're spending it on and what card you're using. So it's a brilliant move by Coin. But as consumers, we're gladly going to give that information to them because we're going to get the convenience of a single card. Why a bank didn't think of this? Well, this is the problem with traditional businesses that are entrenched in a business model that's been around and regulated so heavily. So here the media companies and the banks are very similar. They look at the regulation and they sort of optimize their business practice around regulation instead of optimizing around the free market. Now that makes companies...
Or around the customer.
Well, that certainly is the last person they're thinking of. You know, I speak from some experience here. I'm a customer of Wells Fargo, and I've been living with the pain of that experience for a long time. I'm very open to suggestions, by the way. I may be switching over to Movement Bank soon.
Have you heard about the JPM, Ask JPM fiasco this week?
I did hear about a big Twitter blow up, right?
Yeah, it was funny. It's funny. Look, let's continue the theme of this after the break, Robert. I'd like to sort of talk about the next 5 to 10 years where we go with this, some of the more interesting disruptive things that are happening right now, and specifically what you think might happen and the speed with which it might happen in the banking space. Is that okay?
Sure.
Great. We'll be right back after this break. You're with Brett King and Robert Turcek. We're talking Breaking Banks.
business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Game-changing technologies are transformational, exciting, and disruptive for a reason. They shake up the status quo. They get you thinking about new ways to scale, compete, and grow. They move you in amazing new directions. You're invited to take a coffee break with Game Changers on Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time for our special series on today's top big data innovators. Learn about emerging big trends and technologies and how you can grow your business and profit. Startup Focus with Game Changers, presented by SAP on the Business Channel.
Is your business model robust enough? In today's ever-changing business environment, people are working to transform themselves, their futures, and their business. Tune in to Business Reinvention with your host, Nancy Lynn. To stay ahead of the game in business, you have to constantly reinvent yourself and your organization. With Nancy's experience and that of her guest experts, you'll learn from stories of inspiration, innovation, and forward thinking. Listen for Business Reinvention live every Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Brett King and Robert Turchuk. We've been talking about disruptions in the media and disruptions in other industries. So, Robert, we've been talking about regulated industries that have some sort of licensing structure or lobby the government so they get some competitive advantage in terms of barrier to entry. What other industries right now that are heavily regulated, apart from the likes of banking and TV, are being disrupted by changes in distribution and changes in consumer behavior?
Well, there's one industry that I'm fascinated by right now. It is the regulated gaming business. The video game business has gone through a massive transformation in the past 15 years, just a gigantic series of shifts, some traumatic shifts, and a ton of innovation. Right now, if you look at Facebook
and games, you look at these big titles like Call of Duty and so forth. $1 billion in less than a week, putting
Grand
Hollywood
Theft Auto.
To shame.
These are bigger than movie openings when they open up. They're gigantic. And the competitive pressure is unbelievable. There are thousands of new games launched on iTunes each week for the iPhone. So the competitive nature of this industry, of the video game business, is super intense. It's hard to imagine a more competitive business. And that drives great innovation. So just in the last few years, since 2009, we've seen gigantic waves of innovation go through the game industry. However, the regulated gaming business has not changed at all.
So you're talking about casinos and lotteries?
Casinos and lotteries. Yes, casinos and lotteries haven't changed at all. If you go to a Vegas casino, you'll see the same things that you saw 10 or 20 years ago. Sure, they've got a couple gimmicks, like a robot dealer for blackjack or something. No one's playing those games. And then you look at a big floor full of slot machines that's practically empty. And that's because the people that want those game experiences, they're dying off. Their demographic's starting to look like smokers. They're poor, they're urban, they're less educated, they're less affluent. And frankly, they're not going to the casinos as much. So the casinos face this demographic challenge. They need to reinvent their product for a younger demographic. And as it turns out, the lottery business is much bigger than the casino business. And you might not have realized that. I didn't know that until I started getting into it. Yeah, it's much bigger. In the U.S., the U.S. lottery business in the U.S. states, 44 states and 3 territories, it's about a $68 billion business, where the casinos, the Vegas-style casinos, is a $37 billion business. And then the tribal business, that's about $26 or $27 billion. That's the tribes that have casinos in various U.S. states. altogether, you're looking at a U.S. ecosystem that's about almost $150 billion, $130 billion ecosystem. And globally, gambling of all sorts is about a $400 billion ecosystem. So it's almost the size of the television industry. It's gigantic, and it's much bigger than the video game business. And yet, these guys have not innovated at all. And, you know, the casinos are smart. They're run by smart guys. They're highly technical. They're highly tech savvy. They are acquiring Facebook companies that make great free games on Facebook. So they're not stupid. These guys are doing what they can to migrate their business. They are regulated, and they optimize their business for the regulator. So they have to be very careful to move at the pace of a regulator and not push things too fast. Because the key thing is you never want to get in trouble with the regulator. If you lose your license,
regulators don't move very fast, do they?
Regulators do not move fast, and legislation takes forever. I have been talking to lotteries and casinos since the 1990s, and it's only this year, 2013, that they're actually starting to begin to launch internet gaming. So it's been more than 10 years, almost 15 years. That's how slowly they move. Now, you might say, well, gosh, they're defended, they're regulated, they're doing fantastically well, they're profitable, so what's the issue? Why do they need to change? Here's the problem. If you go on Facebook today and you look at any type of social gambling game, these are virtual casinos, they don't give out cash prizes.
Would you classify Candy Crush in that category?
It's an issue. Let me come to that in just a second, because Candy Crush is a super successful game, and there are several in that category. They feel like kind of arcade-style games or casual games, but they do have elements, dynamics within those games that are much more like akin to a slot machine and a gambling-style game. Now, remember, you're not paying any cash. You can play these games for free, and the rule of a regulated game is you have to pay some money or some kind of consideration, and then there's an element of chance in the game, and then there's some sort of cash prize or some prize that has value, right? Those three things. If those three conditions are true, then it's a lottery or a casino game, and it will be regulated. And the government's very efficient about taking down anything that is that violates that. So the games on Facebook that are free to play have gently skirted this issue. They come right up to the edge of the regulatory boundary. You might say they go over the edge from time to time and test it. Games like Candy Crush, I'm not trying to say Candy Crush is a gambling game. I would never make that assertion. But what I would do is say that they are hitting the exact same center in the brain that gets conditioned to respond to a gambling game, and they're playing off of that part of your brain, which is not really the most conscious segment of your brain, right? It's at sort of the reptilian level. They get you excited about these games. They predict development. The big difference between the free games and the paid games is that you win all the time in the free games, so you get hooked really quickly. They're highly addictive, these free games on Facebook. So what I see happening is that there's a whole generation growing up now that plays free games that are almost like gambling, but they don't pay cash, or they don't pay a lot of cash. You don't have to pay. It's optional to pay. It's free to play. You can upgrade to paid if you want. And you don't win cash prizes. People are getting conditioned to that because they win more. And what's happening is then they go to a lottery or a casino. Those products just look stale and dull by comparison, and
that's
lose more and more. Now, it's important.
I never thought about it like that.
You have people in their missile silo, right? People are in their silo.
It's changing the game of winning, right? It's changing our perception of what it is to win.
That's exactly right. If you go play My Vegas on Facebook, which I happen to love, I think it's a great game. It's built by Play Studios. I have no affiliation with them. It's just a game that a developer friend showed me because he knew I was interested, and he said, this is the best. And I looked at it. I thought, all right, I'll spend a minute playing this game. 4 hours later, I snapped out of the trance, and I had played, I had leveled up to the 11th level or something. It was crazy. I just got so into it. It's absolutely brilliant. They are insidious games, and eventually what will happen as you play those games is you'll hit a pay barrier, but you might play 50, you could play, for hours. You can play up to 50 levels of Candy Crush without paying, but eventually you do hit the pay barrier, and if you switch to pay, if you put your credit card information, then the game shifts to a money game, but they don't tell you that. And the game changes tremendously, almost automatically. And now suddenly it's an extremely difficult game. The game level, the difficulty level ramps up. And so you need to go for those paid points and the power boosts and stuff. So it's quite brilliant how they've designed these games. They've designed it around the psychology of the player. The free games on Facebook are so complicated. There's so many things going on that your brain starts to lose track, so you're a little bit distracted, and you might click that pay button without even thinking of it. So I think they're a little bit deceptive, you might say exploitative. Now, in some countries, in Belgium, France, and in Japan, government regulators are looking at these free games because they're saying, wait, they are so close to a regulated game that maybe we should regulate. I don't think the U.S. is likely to do that because we're pretty hands-off. But when I talk to the state lotteries, I say, listen, you've got to be aware of this because these games are conditioning your customers to a different kind of game experience. And that really matters for states because the lottery is the one tax people don't mind paying. Right. You know, people happily pay the lottery tax. They enjoy playing it. They feel like they get something out of it. For governments, this is a really important revenue source. For state governments in the U.S. and national governments elsewhere, this is what pays for sometimes police departments, cultural things.
Can you put in your lottery numbers on your mobile phone yet, or you still have to go and buy a ticket?
Amazingly, in the U.S., you cannot do it. There's only two states that have authorized online gaming, and they're just launching it. And also with casinos in the U.S., in Vegas now you can do poker on the internet, and New Jersey just passed the legislation to legalize online gaming. So it's just starting to happen now. In 2014, you'll start to see more of this come. But in Europe already, most European countries have already launched some sort of online gambling or lottery. So the Europeans are a few years ahead of the Americans here. So if you want to learn about this, I would recommend going to Europe.
Okay, so let's get back into thinking about the banking state. And sure. It's interesting from a revenue perspective. One of the things that I've been doing quite a bit of work on in the last couple of months is these revenue moments, which you can capture via mobile. So an example would be you're in a store, your grocery store, and your salary hasn't come, your salary hasn't come through yet. It's supposed to come through on the 15th, but 15th is a Saturday and you're a bit short and you want to buy your groceries. There's an opportunity there for a bank to say, yeah, we'll spot you the money. We'll give you an immediate overdraft or immediate line of credit. Here it is. Things like that, moments that can bring small amounts of revenue instead of that free checking model, which relies on, or credit card model, which relies on hefty, interest rate fees and things like that.
Yeah.
So I think mobile has this potential to really disrupt the way people capture revenue. And a lot of it is about that relationship, bringing people, giving them something they can trust that they'll use every day, and then picking up those revenue moments as they appear. Do you think that is really going to change the way we think about the economics of these businesses?
Yeah, I think you touched on something that's so important.
The mobility element?
Well, Brett, a little while ago, before the break, you mentioned thinking about customers first, and I think that message is so important we need to underscore it here. I feel like my bank harvests me as a customer. They're harvesting me for fees, unnecessary fees. They're harvesting me for additional services that I don't want. They're harvesting me for my time. I have to go to the bank because when I deposit a check or something, I need a signature from from a manager or something. So they forced me to comply with their process, and they charge me for the privilege. That's a lousy business model. So what happens with disruptors is they look at that and they say, hang on a second, let's rethink the entire equation here. We're trying to serve a customer. Can we give them a better service at a lower cost where they feel more valued? So the disruptors come in because they're not governed by regulation, because they're free to move and they're free to rethink the business model. They don't have a legacy business and physical branches to protect. They can come in and rethink the whole equation and come out with a business model that's entirely different. But it begins with a customer experience that's got to be superior. People won't switch until they feel like they have a trusted company that they can go to that will give them a better service, better treatment at a lower price.
But it sounds like a lot of people are ready to switch though.
Yes,
so
that's exactly right. And I think you're gonna find that happens very quickly here. You know, one of your phrases is that banking is something we need. Banking as a verb is something that we need, but physical banks aren't necessarily something that we need. I think that's a really good point. Every day, trillions of dollars are exchanged that exist only in digital form. They've never existed as physical currency. Most of the dollars in the world don't exist as cash. They exist as digital currency. So already, in part of our brain, we sort of bifurcated our brains. There's a part of us that can deal with the idea of digital currency and electronic transfers. And there's another part of us that actually really likes the green stuff, the coins, the tangible stuff, and we're kind of attached to that. We see a lot of value there. I think as people get more and more trusting of digital and more fed up with the fees and the nickeling, diming, and getting chiseled by your bank, the bad treatment that you get from the bank, I think they're going to be more and more open to disruptive companies. In other words, the banks have created this problem for themselves. I've advised a couple of banks now. I've had an interesting time doing it because I don't know much about the banking industry. And frankly, I was inspired by your book, Bank 3.0, which I think is brilliant. And there's a whole section in that book that talks about the physical brand.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's really important to read. When I spoke to the casino industry just a couple of months ago, I spoke at the big G2E, it's the big technology conference for the casinos. I said, look, there isn't a good book to read about the future of casinos, but I can recommend a book for you. It's Bank 3.0, and just take the word bank out and replace it with casino. It's the exact same thing. All a casino is a bank that only gives you 97 cents when you take $100 out. It's the same exact business, right? So, and so they should begin to think about the amount they're investing in physical structures.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Too bad. All right.
No, that's all right. So thanks very much for being on the show. Check out RobertTurcek.com, Inventing the Future. Turcek is spelled T-E-R-C-E-K. And Robert, thanks very much. We'll have to continue this discussion on another show soon.
Super. It's fun talking to you.
Thanks very much. You've been with Brett King and Robert Turcek on Breaking Bank. Sorry we've run out of time. This discussion could have gone on for another hour, but we'll continue it next week. Thanks again, guys. Thanks again, Rob.
Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.